Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 28th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Christ and Culture, Five Models for Christian Life. Our presenter is Paul Bosch, session number BOP 2006-01. Let's listen in.
Quarter two, and we're supposed to have an hour, isn't that so? Quarter to 11 to a quarter to 12. Give us time to wash our hands for lunch. I'm Paul Bosch. My name is Paul Bosch, and this ought to be the beginning of a series on the arts and worship, worship and its arts. And if you want to look me up on the web when you get home, worship.ca. Do you see it there? I don't know whether you have a computer or not, but I've been writing an essay on worship every month. 107 of them so far, 10 years worth. And I've heard other people say, not just because my stuff is there, but I've heard other people say that it's the best website on worship in the whole internet. Internationally. Good. Roman Catholics don't have a better one. Episcopalians don't have a better one. Presbyterians don't have a better one. The Lutheran Church in Canada, that's the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, the sister church across the border, as you may know. They've got a dynamite editor who knows all about computers, for one thing, and then he's got a finger in every pie you can think of. Church architecture, spirituality, church music, etc. And I've done several things for this website, including this ongoing essay on worship. And I've printed out a couple of them here if you want to see them, including one, Couch Potato Prayers. We'll get to that later. Okay, let me begin at the very beginning and do some, background stuff. Some of you are the fans of John Updike. Have you read any books by John Updike? He's a favorite of mine. And he writes a book called Roger's Version. And every clergy person, man or woman, ought to read Roger's Version, because it's about a parish pastor who goes to seminary and he's teaching now at seminary. He's a PhD and he's teaching patristics, as a matter of fact, which is the early church teachers. And at one point in the book, he's in conversation with his niece. And his niece says, "Well, Uncle Roger, you're really a salesman for religion, aren't you?" And he says, "Well, when I was in the parish, I was a salesman for religion, but," he says, "now that I'm teaching at seminary, I'm in quality control." And I thought that was neat. So what you're getting here in these sessions is, in a sense, quality control. That is to say, you're listening in on some shop talk among professionals, and I'm here to kick off that shop talk. I think I want to speak maybe half an hour and then open the door for your comments and questions. If you want to interrupt me along the way, you can feel free to do that too. Okay, let us begin at the beginning and talk about the so-called orders of creation. This is an ancient, ancient idea. I'm pretty sure it's before Martin Luther even. The orders of creation. Are the following. These are the areas in human life where you find yourself simply by reason of being born into the world. So, for instance, sex and family is the first one. Everybody here, everybody in the world, is the child of one male and one female, and we're parents, we're grandparents, we're ourselves children of others, we're spouses. All of that stuff is the sex in the family, and in a sense you can't do anything about it. I mean, the fact that I have blue eyes, that is just part of the package. I suppose I could wear colored contact lenses, but I mean, that's part of my genetic makeup. Okay, that's the first order of creation. Second, the state, and by the state is meant civil government. Everybody is born into a place where there's some kind of civil government. And sometimes the civil government works, and sometimes it doesn't work. We're seeing a lot of cases in Africa where the civil government is just falling apart, as you may know. But I was born as an American in Buffalo, New York, and I lived much of my life there, but I'm now living in Canada, and I'm a Canadian citizen as well. So I have dual citizenship, and I can vote in both places. So the state, the structures of civil government, that's the second order of creation. The third is economic order. That is to say, what's your job? How do you put bread on your table? Butcher, baker, candlestick maker, teacher, pastor, whatever. And of course, at the macro level, you got capitalism and communism, you got socialism, you got all those isms, and all of those are part of the human package too. And of course, you can change these, but as I say, you're born into a situation, and at the very beginning anyhow, you have to learn to live within that situation. Later on, perhaps you can change it. Sex and family, state. Now, the so-called cultural orders. These are sometimes grouped together and simply called culture, but I like to separate them out because they're really three separate things here. Let's say the cultural order of science, education, and medicine. Human beings are pretty smart. They like to learn stuff. They like to invent stuff. Okay, you've got science, you've got technology, you've got education, you've got medicine. All of those are the cultural order of the first cultural order. The next cultural order would be the arts. And I'm thinking now of painting, sculpture, architecture, music, poetry, literature. We got Shakespeare, we have Chartres Cathedral, we have the Eiffel Tower, we have all of the arts that make our life richer, presumably. And I love this. This is from Christopher Stendhal. What the arts do is give you a holy itch, a holy yearning. If life is not the way you want it to be, art can give you a holy itch, a holy yearning to do something about it and make it better. Sometimes by showing the negative, the Godfather movie. Have you seen the Godfather? Ooh, it's terrible, but it's one of the greatest movies ever made, in my view. Sometimes the arts, you know, show you the bad stuff. And sometimes they show you the good stuff, but in any case, it's a holy itch, it's a holy yearning. And even this, my pen is running out here. Play, leisure time. Red Skelton, some of you are old enough to remember Red Skelton, great clown on television years ago. He was a Christian. I think he's gone now, isn't he? I think he died. But he said that he understands that God gave him the gift to help people to laugh. And it's a sad world, and he should know. I think he lost a child, during the child's growing up. And he said if he can make people laugh, if he can entertain people, that's a God-given gift, and he's going to use that gift. I admire that. Play, leisure, I'll say even entertainment. Okay, so what we're talking about is all of these things. These are the structures of human life in which you find yourself. And I'm going to use now H. Richard Niebuhr. Do you know that name? A book, Christ and Culture. I looked for it in the library and didn't find it in a cursory examination, but I'm pretty sure it's there. I want to see if I can get it for next time, perhaps. But H. Richard Niebuhr says that people have been trying to understand how they are to live in all of these structures of culture, all these orders of creation. And when they do that, down through history, they've come up with five answers. That's what we're going to take a look at now. Incidentally, Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, good Lutheran saint, he prefers to talk of mandates instead of orders of creation, the mandates of creation. When you're born into a family, it's your mandate to make something of that. If you're born into a civic society, it's your mandate to make something out of that. Same with all the others. And it's not just that you're to serve your neighbor there. You're certainly supposed to do that. But you are also to exercise lordship. Isn't that neat? We don't hear that often enough. I heard that from Carol Hinderly. Any of you know Carol Hinderly? Raise your hand. Way back in the old days, he invented this place. He's Paul Hinderly's father. And he invented Holden Village. And his preaching turned my preaching inside out. Because he talked about our lordship as Christians over the world. And that, the best kind of lordship, not, you know, patronizing or misusing, but nurturing that creation. And that was an important thing for me to hear. He quoted Luther, Carol Hinderly. He said, Luther says this, "We are the Lord's, with and without the apostrophe." I like that. We are the Lord's, L-O-R-D, apostrophe S, we belong to Jesus, right? But we are also the Lord's, without the apostrophe, we are kings and queens in our world, and we have a responsibility and a joy to do something there. Now, as I say, Dietrich Bonhoeffer likes the idea of mandates of creation. These are the orders, these are the structures of human life where you find yourself, and it's time to get to work. Okay, five answers. This is a continuum now. It's not a timeline, but it shows you, I hope, graphically, a picture of how Christians have answered that question. How do I live in the world with all these responsibilities? The first one, I should say, I'm going to give you all five of them, and each of the five appear one after the other in human history. However, at the same time, you can find all of the five in our present day experience. And maybe you can find all of the five in every human heart. So, let's take a look now. This is a kind of a picture, intending to be a kind of a picture, of what the answers might be to the question, how do we live in the orders of creation? Incidentally, H. Richard Niebuhr, who wrote this book, Christ and Culture, says that culture, orders of creation, are the secondary environment which human beings impose upon the natural environment. You got the natural environment, trees, rocks, mountains, and so on. Now, we come in and we build a village here. That's culture. And we have a musicale with a flute and a violin in the village center. That's culture. Now, how do we do it? Well, the first answer call it A. Oh, boy, this isn't much good either. See if I can find yet another one. This arose even during the New Testament. You can find this view in the New Testament. I suppose you can find parts of all of these views in the Bible, including the New Testament. But the very first Christians saw the world positively or negatively. They're being fed to the lions, remember?
Negatively,
right. They thought the world was the enemy. So the first position here of the five, H. Richard Niebuhr calls Christ against culture. The culture is bad news. Caesar, number two there, state, Caesar is going to feed you to the lions or burn you at the stake. So the culture is looked at very negatively. The first view, Christ against culture, shall I put that down? I use the X to stand for Christ. It's really a chi, that's a Greek letter, the first two letters, C-H-R-I-S-T, Christ. So when you see Xmas, it's not being, what's the word? It's not being irreverent. It's simply an easy way to write Christ. So this is Christ against culture. Christ against culture. Caesar and his armies are bad. Even sex in the family is bad. And you have, for instance, the monastic movement growing up where you did not get married. It's better not to get married. You can see that in St. Paul too. But if you have to, go ahead and get married. It's better to marry than to burn. Anyhow, in this very, very extreme view, it says the people who held that view back in the Bible days and right after the Bible days, they said, stay away from all of those things. The economic order, do not earn your own living. Beg from door to door. And you had a whole group of people begging from door to door, quite literally. Same with science, education, and medicine. They're going to lead you astray. Anything that science comes up with, technology, education, all that stuff is bad news. Same with the arts, museums, the workshop of the devil. I mean, I'm being very extreme, but I want to point out to you what this view means at its most extreme. And of course, leisure and play and entertainment, that would be naughty as well. So this first view is extreme left and very negative toward culture. Then, in the 4th century, we're talking now 300s, what happened? Something very significant.
Conversion of Constantine.
What was it?
Conversion of Constantine.
The conversion of Constantine, exactly. Constantine is the Roman emperor, and he is converted. On his deathbed, I think, as a matter of fact. But right away, Christianity is not only tolerated, but it is becoming the official religion of the empire. Wow. 180 degrees. Completely different picture. Here's B. He calls this the Christ of culture. And these are the people who say, hey, there's no problem. Of course, Christ is a family man. Of course, Christ endorses the government, whatever it is. Of course, Christ endorses the economic structures of your world. Of course, Christ has no problem with education or science or medicine or the arts or any of those things. So this view is 180 degrees opposite to the very earliest view. You can, as I said a minute ago, you can find people today who have this view, hold this view. You can find people today who hold this view. So, as I say, these are chronological, but they're also simultaneous even today. And maybe simultaneous in your own heart. I must say, there's something attractive about that far left view to me. And there's also something attractive about the far right view to me. So you have the days when the church now is on top of things. And the church is beginning to baptize the state, the economic system, whatever, and beginning to take charge. And you've got a state, a state church in some cases, but you've got a church in any event that has power and prestige and privilege that it never had before. It certainly didn't have it back in these days. But now it does. And that conversion of Constantine, that was a significant watershed in human life. And there are those who say, and I think I would be with them, that the Constantinian era that began in the year 325 or whatever, ended last Thursday. Well, it ended probably in the 50s, 1950. And we are now in a post-Constantinian era. And our world today, in North America as well as a lot of other places in the world, is more like the first four centuries than like any of the centuries in between. Okay, we got the far left view, we got the far right view. Now, it happens that there are three views in the middle. Kind of compromises. I have to blow my nose here a minute. You want to talk for a minute? Talk, turn and talk to your neighbor. See if any of this makes sense. I'll blow the whistle in 1 minute. Okay. Are we ready to go? That wasn't a minute, was it? But you know. Now we have three compromise positions. And they're somewhere in the middle here. Position C is High Roman Catholicism. All of these positions in the middle say, well, there's a certain autonomy and a certain authenticity about all of these structures of creation. And they have their own rules and their own ways of doing things, and they're not necessarily bad. But Christ and obedience to Christ has its own rules too. So these views in the middle are trying to mediate. And the Roman Catholic answer to that, 11th century, 12th century, that says, well, all of these things are good. Sex, family, state, economic order, cultural order, science, education, medicine, arts, and so on. All of those are good. All of those can kind of go their own way, but you need Christ and Christ's people, Christ's men, I might add, was always male, in there to legitimize it, to make it really proper. So, for instance, if there's a conflict between the king and the pope, guess who wins? The Pope. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm a Canadian, and these days I'm getting to know, I've been there 24 years, but I'm beginning to understand the Canadian system. And of course, we have the Queen. The Queen is part of the Commonwealth. Canada is part of the Commonwealth, has its own rules, its own constitution, and so on. But nevertheless, our allegiance is to the Queen. Guess who crowns the Queen? Archbishop of Canterbury. Right. Now, nobody pays much attention to it, but I mean, that's a remnant, you see, of this position number C. And he calls this Christ. What'll I say? I'm forgetting my words here. Christ, let's say, the custodian of culture. You need Christ's people there, particularly Christ's men, the priest, the bishop, the pope, to be the custodian of culture. So, for instance, in the early Middle Ages, you had the churches doing a great work from one perspective, building universities, building hospitals. I mean, those were great days for the church. I'm not sure they were such great days for faith, but they were great days for the church. And, let's be fair, the church did a great work with hospitals, universities, stuff like that. Technology, how the Irish saved civilization. Have you read that book? I mean, the Dark Ages, as they say, were really pretty terrible. And it was the monasteries that kept learning alive. The monasteries had the manuscripts, you know, from Plato and Aristotle and so on. And they copied them over. And that's how the Irish saved civilization, the Irish monasteries. There were other monasteries, too. But anyhow, that's the third position now. And it's somewhere in the middle there. And you still need Christ to legitimize everything, and Christ's people. Okay, along comes, ta-da, the 15th century. Martin Luther. Christ and culture in paradox. Okay, Martin Luther comes along and he has a different view of things. He says each of these things are important, each of them has their own legitimacy, each of them has their own authenticity and their own rules and their own ways of doing things. It all belongs, however, at the left hand of God, says Martin Luther. The right hand of God, it's a nice picture, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of anthropomorphic, but it's a nice picture. The right hand of God is the gospel and the preaching of the gospel. And there's no persuasion there. It's only persuasion. There's no sword. There's no compulsion. In the left hand, all of these things here, you need compulsion. You've got the state there, the structures of civic government, to put malefactors in jail. So the state has the power, you see, and should have the power to compel obedience. But you can't have that kind of power and that kind of coercion in the right hand of God. The right hand of God, that's the gospel, and simple persuasion of the Spirit. Martin Luther would even go so far as to say this: sex and family, state, economic order, cultural orders, arts, play, all of that is, get this, an Adamite ordinance. A-D-A-M-I-T-E. I should write that down, shouldn't I? Adamite means it began with Adam. Jesus didn't invent marriage. Adam and Eve did. They're all at the left hand of God. Same with government. Same with earning your living, the economic system. Same with the cultural orders and so on. All of those belong at the left hand of God, and they're not at the right hand of God. Love, God's love, is active in both. But if there's ever a conflict, you just have to walk that tightrope, and maybe you'll fall off on this side, and maybe you'll fall off on that side. None of your moral decisions are pure or altogether righteous or altogether unalloyed, undiluted good. Almost every ethical decision you make has good and bad in it. And all of these things at the left hand of God represent, again, the way you live in world as a Christian, keeping your own Christian faith in tension with it. Martin Luther would say that there's no such, you can't use Christian, here's another good thing, you can't use the word Christian, again, here's one of my abbreviations. You never use, if you're a Lutheran, you never use the word Christian as an adjective, always as a noun. It's Christians who do these things. But there's no such thing as Christian politics. There's no such thing as, get this, Christian marriage. A lot of Buddhist and Hindu and Muslim marriages put Christian marriages to shame. There's no such thing as a Christian economic system. Capitalism can be pretty bad if it's left unchecked. You got questions along the way? Feel free to raise your hand if you have a question. Same with all of these things. There's no such thing as Christian art. Good art or bad art, but and some of it is done by Christians, good and bad. But you always use Christian as a noun if you're going to be Lutheran. Now, a lot of people aren't Lutheran, including some Lutherans. You want to pursue that? Let's move along. D.E., the final one, is John Calvin. Oh, dear, this is frustrating. A, B, C, D, E, yeah. Okay, this is Christ the Transformer of culture. John Calvin comes along and he invents a new sewage system for the city of Geneva. He says Christian people ought to get into politics and transform it. Great idea, huh? Would that we all did that. Same with the family, same with the economic system, same with all of those things at the left hand of God. Calvin wouldn't talk about the left hand of God. He would talk about transforming those orders of creation, those mandates, from the standpoint of the Christian faith and making them better. Lutherans, for instance, FD, can you read my D there? Lutherans are good at binding up wounds. Calvinists are good at stopping the wounds from being made in the first place. You know, the Lutheran World Federation has an incredible, very, very fine international reputation for refugee resettlement and taking care of the poor who are displaced and oppressed in their countries. Lutheran World Federation, I think maybe Catholic, well, I don't even think the Catholic World Service is has got as fine a reputation as the Lutherans do. But if you're a Calvinist, you say, hey, here are all these people coming down the river all beaten up and bruised and bloody. Let's go up the river and change what's making that happen. So, you know, we have to listen to the Calvinists too. I think we ought to listen to all of them, but all of them together, it seems to me, represent what? You know, all of them are in my own breast, and maybe all of them are in your breast as well. Is now a good time to take a break and say, what do you want to do with this? Let's talk. Had you heard some of this before? Let me give you an example of D while you're thinking of something to say. Did you see the last? Concluding episode, I guess you'd call it, of MASH. Remember MASH on television? Boy, that was a good show. The concluding episode was an hour long instead of just a half an hour. And it was a very dark story, because Hawkeye and his American buddies, this is supposed to be now in Korea, isn't it, I think?
Mm-hmm.
They're on patrol somewhere, and the enemy is going by outside. And they happen to have a young Korean mother there with her baby. Do you remember this story? And if the baby cries out, they'll be discovered. So she smothers her baby. I mean, she tries to keep the baby from crying, and the price she pays is that the baby is smothered. You ever read The Cruel Sea? Nicholas Montserrat made it into a movie, too. There's an ethical dilemma that's very Lutheran. Here is a convoy going from USA to Britain in the Second World War. And there's a destroyer escort where the hero of the story is the captain. And a submarine, a German submarine, has snuck into the convoy and sunk a British ship. And the survivors of the British ship, his own countrymen, are in the water ahead of him, clamoring to be rescued. And just at that moment, the commander of this destroyer escort gets on his radar the fact that the sub is right below him. So his moral dilemma is, do I stop and pick up my own men and let the sub get away? Or do I drop a depth charge and get the sub so that he won't get any more ships, and in that, kill my own men? And I think that's what he does, as a matter of fact. He drops the depth charge, he kills the submarine, and he also kills his own men. And, says Martin Luther, that's the kind of decision Christians are faced with every day. And then there's a wonderful line in the book, I'm not sure whether it's in the movie or not, but he says, you simply, the commander of the ship says, you simply have to do what you think is best and say your prayers. And ask God's forgiveness. Have you heard sin boldly? Have you heard that before? That's Martin Luther. And that's what he means by sin boldly. You're never going to have your hands clean. You have to depend on God's grace. Now, some of the other positions would try to keep your hands clean. And I suppose even Luther would want to try to keep your hands clean. But a lot of times you can't. I would even say 98% of the choices you make have some good and some bad in them. Okay, now surely you've thought of something to say.
So how would the Calvinists have handled that situation rather than Luther to prevent the submarine?
Yeah, you're observing that, no. that's a tough moral decision.
No war.
No war.
Say it again.
No war, that the war would have
no been. War, yeah, oh boy. I have a dear friend who teaches at the seminary where I taught, Waterloo, Ontario, has a little Lutheran seminary, and I taught there. And my friend on the faculty was giving a lecture, and he talked about the Mennonites. There are a lot of Mennonites where I live. And he said, the Mennonites, you know, that's a peace church. And right away it clicked in my head, that means the Lutherans are a war church. I mean, that's too often the case. You know, that's one of the problems with this view. Being so altogether positive about the culture, you know, if you're a German in 1940 and Hitler says, burn the Jews, do you burn the Jews? If you're an American in 2006 and George Bush says, invade Iraq, That view is, for me, too, at its worst, it's not critical enough. Go ahead.
Why were the early Christians so negative, and what was the attraction of becoming?
Can you speak good and loud? I'm deaf as a post.
Why were the early Christians so negative, and why would it be attractive to people to become followers?
Why would?
Under A.
Why don't?
Yeah, the first view.
Yeah.
That's very negative about all these things.
Right. Why is it?
So why would it?
Why is it negative? And why, if it's so negative, how does it attract people to the church?
I'm still not getting you.
If it's so negative, why does it attract people to the church?
Oh. Yeah, maybe it doesn't. there's a piety even today, don't you think, that thinks that movies are naughty and, all that stuff. Now, they're not very consistent, because movies may be naughty, but the American free enterprise system is perfectly okay. I'm not sure that's a satisfactory answer. Some of the rest of you have an answer. We can have the conversation going this way as well.
Well, I think the negativity is against the culture, right? So the culture is the one that, you know, even like today, where we're in a culture where, things are happening around us where we're saying, we're really questioning our life, how we live our life, I guess. And so escaping that status quo is attractive.
Definitely.
So that's their way of thinking. And you have that today in Christian...
Trying to keep yourself clean, right spotted.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So try to leave the culture and try to redefine your own existence with Christ.
You want to see the Bible here. First John, the first letter of John. You know, beloved, how does he say it? Beloved, stay away from the world. The world is going to seduce you away from faith. St. Paul, he's a Lutheran. That may not be a satisfactory answer yet, but I can see where that far left position could be attractive. Uh-huh. If you're trying to keep yourself unspotted by the world. Right. Trouble is, a lot of times you're very selective about the things you choose.
Well,
go ahead.
2006 election. I'm looking at the platforms that are coming out. Pro-life, right here, education. There's a big creation story.
Creation
in the science books. These things are going to determine a lot of dollars are going to be poured into this campaign that's coming up.
Yeah.
Over some of these culture orders. And our society is really at war with each other in our American.
Suspicion of evolution, that mm-hmm. kind of thing, yeah.
And it's becoming a political issue in this country at this election time there. It's on the platform.
Here's a great quote for you from St. Augustine. All truth is from God. I like that. If it's true, it's from God. If it's true, it will lead you to God. It won't lead you away from God. Mm-hmm. So we should not fear the truth.
Well, I was picking up on that. Isn't it interesting on that beat position, the Christ of culture, that back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you had a real Christian emphasis on who were the leaders in the civil rights and the transformation of society. And, you know, it was the church, which we would view as kind of the left wing of the church. So what's happened? Now it's all of a sudden it's the right wing of the church that sees its moral leadership in creating a society that does promote intelligent design, that promotes what, you know, the different aspect. Yeah.
So some of you were around in the 60s, and I was already 5 years of pastor, and I was a university chaplain most of my life, a campus pastor, and I loved the 60s. I mean, it was very difficult and scary, but was there ever excitement there? Just look at that. The civil rights movement, mm-hmm. the peace movement, women's lib, gay lib, the ecology movement, and the Second Vatican Council that turned Roman Catholicism inside out. Now, what, 30 years later, 40 years later, all of that stuff, including the Second Vatican Council reforms, are under attack.
Uh-huh. The pendulum has swung, right?
Yeah, the pendulum has swung in a completely opposite direction.
Exactly. And now it's scary.
Back to point A and what this comment was. Is this why we have monasteries? And I have a friend in a religious order, and they have all these rules. And are these people that are afraid to live in the order in the center?
Yeah, you've heard a comment. Are these people in the monasteries afraid to live in the world? You hear that criticism of monasteries sometimes.
Well, I don't know that it's criticism, but it's a choice that they...
Yeah, right. And I have heard monastics, monks, say, well, we're really in the world because we want to affect what goes on. And we think we can do that in our community. And so I've come to respect the monastic movement. Yes, it's kind of world renouncing. It kind of moves toward the A, doesn't it? But nevertheless, boy, some of those Benedictines and Franciscans and so on, they are right in the forefront of the civil rights movement and the peace movement and the rest of it. I mean, they could teach Lutherans a thing or two. So.
There's another part of it. Joseph Palmer has written a book maybe in the last 5 years ago called The Active Life. And so his idea is that you must be well-grounded. You must be very centered, and you must have a monastic way about yourself in order to be active in the life, in order to have some transformation, so they kind of go hand in hand in his writings. So I guess the monastic life is a way into society, you know, into living in the world. So it's another way of looking at it.
And it may be that they're also providing a model. Mm-hmm. This is the way you live in community. And, you know, Thomas Merton, have you read any of his stuff? Or, you could think of some others too. But they are trying to remake the world. And I heard a fellow on TV, a handsome young man dying of AIDS, as a matter of fact. This was 10 years ago. And he said, no matter what happens to me, I am determined to live in the world as it ought to be, and not in the world as it is. And I had to admire that. You know, this guy is gonna live proleptically. Do you know that word? Oh, that's a wonderful word, my favorite word. One of my favorite words. Proleptic means it comes before it's supposed to. And if you live with eschatological prolepsis, oh boy, there's a mouthful. Eschatological means looking for the future. There was a time when I just got out of seminary, that all the scholars were going to the Bible, particularly the New Testament, and saying, boy, Jesus, everything Jesus does is a proleptic statement. The Lord's Prayer, give us today our bread for tomorrow. That's really what it says. It's a technical term, that bread there, is a technical term, the way I heard it back in those days, for the ration that a Roman army officer would get today that was supposed to satisfy him tomorrow. You see what I mean? So when we say, give us today our daily bread, what we're really saying is, give us those gifts today that we shouldn't rightly have until tomorrow, until heaven. And I hear Jesus coming into the world and saying, look, you can claim today the authority that you weren't supposed to have until heaven. In Jesus' day, only God could forgive sins, and only in heaven. Your sins would be forgiven only in heaven. Jesus says, no, I'm doing it today. And I'm giving my followers the authority to do the same thing. You're not supposed to welcome the Gentiles, the uncircumcised, until heaven. Jesus says, no, I'm doing it today. The centurion, the Syrophoenician woman, they are part of God's family today. Wow. That's proleptic. Every February, I should tell you this, every February I wear my eschatological prolepsis necktie. I live in the Great White North, you know, and we have snow up to here. Well, in Holden Village they got snow up to here. But I put on this necktie in February, and it's flowers, all over flowers, you know what I'm saying? And it's meant to be a picture. Hey, folks, you don't know it, but spring is on the way. That's neat, huh? And I think Christians have the authority to live today as if they're in heaven. We don't have to wait. We'll welcome women. We'll welcome children. We'll welcome Gentiles. That's the big fight that Paul had with Peter. You know, Peter was a little nervous. Boy, these people aren't circumcised and they're not keeping kosher and all that. Paul says, fui. I mean, this is Paul Bosch now. Paul says, fui to that. You don't have to worry about that. They're members of the kingdom. One more go round.
I'd like to bring up the situation of the churches, because we've had a change of popes.
The situation?
Popes.
The popes.
A new pope. We have a pope that is very different than what the Catholic Lutheran church I attended. We studied the second ecumenical movement. And we realize one of our former Oregon bishops from California has gone to Rome to be one of the big dignitaries right after the Pope was, what do we call that ceremony when he became Pope?
A cardinal?
Cardinal. Yes, he is now a cardinal. And we realize all the Catholic Church has to do is pull the priest out of our church, and we couldn't exist as a community. And I think of how many priests and nuns we have who aren't active in their orders that have joined our church. And I think if that church disappeared, and when I became aware of all these priests and nuns not working in their usual thing as I thought they were, did, I thought, you know, there's going to be an American Catholic Church and not always a Roman Catholic Church. I heard a lot of unrest about Rome and America at that time. And it's now, yeah. I think the Pope is getting power, and I wonder what's going to, you know, it'll unfold in time, but it's just all happened. since our new Pope is in.
That's this again.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Have you heard of Emma's Church? This is in Oregon. Where is it?
We're near Beaverton. Yeah, it's kind of between Beaverton and Tigard, Oregon.
And it's served by a part-time Roman Catholic priest and a part-time Lutheran minister.
Hmm.
Very unusual.
And through the Catholics requesting from the Lutheran bishop at the last call for Lutheran side pastor, they said, give us a woman. We'll never get it through the Catholic Church. So we
you wonder how long that's going to last with the present pope. The present pope, you know, is reaction. They're trying to bring back Christendom. That's what they're trying to do.
But it's a new time in the church.
Yeah.
You know, I also want to say that how Cardinal Ratzinger, his role in the church, in the Catholic Church, was quite different than he is as Pope. So he was head of the CDS, doctorate, anyway. He was
God's
basically, basically the watchdog of doctrine, you know. And now, as Pope, he's free from that role. So even though we thought he was going to be extremely conservative, I mean, just by the statements he made as Cardinal, he's not making those same statements.
Right.
And if you read, like, the encyclical on love, I mean, that is very... very interesting reading. It's very well thought.
You can endorse it.
Yes. So it's hard to say how things are going to unfold.
But this is just one church person.
Yes.
Well, we do have to quit. Let me tell you that I have here the draft copy of the new hymnal.
Oh, wow.
The new Lutheran hymnal. It won't be this thick. This is cheap paper. The good paper will make it no bigger than the green book. And these are the indexes, if anybody wants to take a look at them. We must quit, though, friends.
Will you tell us again the author of...
of this Christ in Culture?
Yes.
Niebuhr. H. Richard Niebuhr. N-I-E-B-U-H-R. Is that worth your while to read?
Is that the ethicist?
Richard Niebuhr was the brother of Reinhold Niebuhr.
Oh, okay.
And Reinhold and Richard both made wonderful contributions. Some are even saying that through this book, Richard may be a more lasting contribution than Reinhold.
Oh, I see.
But it's a terrific book. I should say that he himself, H. Richard Niebuhr, is... Calvinist. So he kind of makes the whole thing moving toward the Calvinism.
Sure.
But Calvinism has its problems too. Each of these has its own problems.
Okay.
Lutherans tend to be quietists.
Was that first letter N or M?
N as a Nancy.
I'll try to have the thing next time. We meet here every time. And next, tomorrow it'll be in the afternoon. Okay.